Hi there, welcome to the Neurodivergent Magic Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Griffith, and I am so excited to have you here. On this podcast, we talk about all forms of neurodivergence, from ADHD to learning disorders to giftedness to autism and more. If any of that sounds familiar, welcome to Neurodivergent Magic.
Hello, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, and welcome back to another episode of the Neurodivergent Magic Podcast. Today, I have a super, super amazing interview for you. Today, I talked with Karen. She is here to talk about the intersection of religious trauma and neurodivergence and how these two things can affect each other. Because obviously, neurotypicals can undergo religious trauma, and neurodivergent people do not automatically go through religious trauma. It's just that sometimes these experiences intersect. And so today we talk about what that's like and how they impact each other. So it really is an amazing conversation. I can't wait for you all to listen. So I won't keep you from it any longer. Here you go.
Hey there, Karen. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you today, Megan?
I am scattered, but good.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. It's been one of those days where, like, I started behind by about 15 minutes and it's been just snowballing all day. So
I know that feeling so well. Oh my goodness.
It happens. You know, it's just life, and it's February.
It is February. Yeah. That's the beginning of the year. Like, we're not that far behind in the grand scheme of things. Hopefully.
Yet.
Yet.
But we're all tired of winter time. At least here in Ohio, we are.
Oh my goodness. Hey, I'm in Ohio too. Have fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're not here to talk about Ohio or feeling scatterbrained, at least not only that. We're here to talk about religious trauma and neurodivergence and how those things intersect and interact. And I can't even tell you when we connected on TikTok, because we've known each other on TikTok for a while now, but when you were like, hey, I can come on the podcast and talk about religious trauma and neurodivergence, like, this huge light bulb went off in my head. I was like, Why have we not talked about this on the podcast before? This is brilliant. Yes. I hate to be like, I'm so excited to talk about trauma, but
but you know, it can be exciting because it can be a really validating thing to hear somebody else's experience. And I think that's something that's fairly unique to neurodivergent people, is that hearing somebody else's experience. And that's really the only reason why I like to talk about mine, is because hearing other people talk about theirs has really helped me. Yeah. So, but yeah, and I know we had, you know, I had kind of volunteered sort of on a fluke there, but, and I was thinking about what we could talk about, and that just popped into my head. So it seemed like maybe the right thing.
Absolutely. It was a divine download for sure.
Here we go. Yeah.
Okay. So before we jump into all of that, I know this is the worst question in the world, but tell us, like, a little bit about you and who you are and your experience with neurodivergence.
Sure.
And maybe your religious background, since we're going to dive into that.
Yeah, no problem. I am a mom of four biological children, one stepson. I'm 44. I have been out of what I would call formal religion now for going on about 18 years, but I grew up through all kinds of different religious faiths and iterations thereof. So I kind of have a breadth of experience. I didn't, like, stay in one thing for a really long length of time. But my mom was born and raised Lutheran. My dad was born and raised Catholic. And so I was Lutheran until I was about 7 years old. And then at that point, we went from a fairly staid Lutheran church to an Assemblies of God Pentecostal church, if that's familiar to you. And that sort of just began a journey through a lot of different religious experiences until I was in my early 20s, when I finally got out of what I would call formalized religion. So that's a little bit where I'm coming from.
Absolutely. So how about your experience with neurodivergence? You know, when did you realize you were neurodivergent? What flavors are you?
What's my alphabet soup?
Yeah.
I actually was first exposed to the whole idea of neurodivergence when my two oldest children were diagnosed on the autism spectrum. So this would have been back in 2002 to 2004, when autism was still not a household name by any stretch. So we were kind of on the cutting edge of that. And I my experience for probably about 10 years there then was neurodivergence as it pertained to them and dealing with their issues and learning about them and just honestly trying to survive the next day, because I had two more children in quick succession after that, who in the end also turned out to be neurodivergent, but we didn't catch on to that as quickly. When I was about 35 years old, 33, 34, I started to go, wait a second. You mean these aren't normal behaviors? As they started to hit kind of puberty in some of the upper grades, and they were starting to change some of the language in IEP meetings about things that were a concern. And I was like, I do that too. Doesn't everybody do that? You know, especially being female versus being socialized male, as my oldest two were. And I had never even heard anything at that point about ADHD in women, let alone autism. That wasn't even on my radar. So I ended up being diagnosed myself with ADHD then when I was about 35 years old. And the autism piece, I'm self-diagnosed. I'm not formally diagnosed with autism itself. But that has just been in the last couple of years as they've become adults. They're 23 and 21 now. And then this huge surgence on TikTok, you know, all of a sudden us neurodivergent women are everywhere and it's fantastic. But it's really sort of helped me come to understand myself a little bit better and how it looks for me. So that's my experience, at least to date, with neurodivergence for myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think there are a lot of moms out there who relate to discovering themselves through, you know, identifying their children. And that totally makes sense why that would happen, especially like you said, as the kids get older and you're like, wait.
Wait, what do you mean? That's not normal.
Right. Because when they're really little. Yeah. Because when they're really little, we don't identify with what they do, because children and adults are so different, but children and teens are a lot closer, and all of a sudden.
Yeah. You know, the language is just different in what they expect them to do developmentally and educationally. So as that starts to change as they age, yeah, it can be interesting. And a lot of us in my generation, you know, Gen X, you know, we got missed because we weren't little white boys who were bouncing off the walls. You know, it wasn't something that was even remotely understood, you know, when I was in school. So.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest shifts that's happening as we speak is this shift from how only paying attention to how neurodivergence affects neurotypicals to shifting like, how does it actually affect the neurodivergent person? And because of that shift, we're identifying so many more people, because there are so many of us who learned to hide and learned to mask and learned to, or were abused into silence. You know, it really depends. And it's really good, I think, that we're finally starting to prioritize the neurodivergent person's lived experience.
I agree wholeheartedly, because, and this is, I'll segue into the trauma, the religious trauma here. You know, you were talking about masking here a second ago. And I think that's one of the ways that a religious experience, especially as a child, can be really harmful. And this is true for neurotypicals as well. I don't mean to diminish their experience at all. But a lot of the things that come with ADHD and autism, being late, having an untidy room, those kinds of things are moralized in a lot of religious settings. For me, it was a Christian experience. So I don't, that was solely, you know, I wasn't experienced with any other major religions, but lots of different flavors of that. But when you moralize those kinds of things to a little kid, I think especially for those of us with neurodivergence, we take everything so literally, especially as little kids. And not that it was even meant literally, but we took it that way, at least for me, I did. And, you know, in hindsight, looking back and went, okay, maybe they didn't mean it that way, but I took those kinds of rights and wrongs and are you going to heaven? Are you going to hell? So literally that it really, that was one of the ways I think it really damaged me. Because it reinforced that black and white thinking. And everything became such a huge, what's the word I want here? Mm-hmm. Almost life or death decision.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Oh, 100%. Yes, absolutely. It does.
Yeah. You know, did you read your Bible every day? Well, maybe a neurotypical would take that question less literally. But to me, I took that as if I didn't read my Bible every single day, no exceptions, was I really saved or not?
Mm-hmm.
Was I going to heaven or hell? You know, and at 8 or 9 years old, you know, you look back at that now as a 44-year-old woman, and I can't even, what in the heck? You know, like, I can't even verbalize yet, I don't think, all of the ways that that has filtered the way that I see the world. And that's just one example.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is it okay if I share something from my church experience?
Please, please do. Please
do. Interesting through the lens of neurodivergence. So I was an altar server.
Okay.
And I was serving for Good Friday Mass, which I know you said you were raised like Lutheran and Catholic, so you probably understand that. But for listeners who don't know, Good Friday is basically the day where we acknowledge the fact that Jesus Christ died. It's like his passion, and it's everything right before Easter. Deeply sad day. So I was serving for that mass or service. I actually don't think it is a mass because we don't serve communion because Jesus is dead. There is no communion to give. So anyway, I was serving for that service, and afterwards, I vividly remember this. My mom came up to me and she was like, "Why do you look like you're about to burst into tears up there? What is wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Your God just died. Why are you not sad? Like, what are you talking about?" I was so confused.
Yeah. About
how she wasn't that affected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate to that. I remember, I didn't have that particular experience, but I remember that Easter weekend in general, there was a lot of emotion. And yeah, I didn't, but my church experience was one where it was expected to display the emotion. So it's interesting to see the dichotomy between two different experiences well, and how that affects you. But yeah, if that's all you understand as a kid, it does. It really, that's a horrible thing. You know, I mean, if you think about what we're taught about that part of scripture, and I won't delve too deep into it because that could have its very own trigger warnings, you know, to go along with it. But for those who are familiar with what that story entails, if you can step back from that as an adult, what a horrific, traumatic thing that is. And yet we tell these stories in front of little kids, and we tell them in some churches and experiences very, very graphically.
Right. And can we just acknowledge the trauma inherent in Palm Sunday?
Yes.
So I'm glad you know what I'm talking about, but yeah. For listeners who maybe didn't have this experience growing up or now, Palm Sunday is where we go through the passion of the Christ and everything. And mm-hmm. What they have you do in a lot of churches is they will have you, the audience or the congregation or whatever, read the part of the Pharisees sentencing Jesus to death. That is your job.
Yeah.
So fucked up.
Okay, I'm glad F-bombs are okay.
oh yeah, I'll just mark it explicit. Don't worry.
Yeah, no, that's so true. You know, and it just occurred to me as you were saying that today is actually Ash Wednesday.
It is.
As we're recording that. And again, for listeners who aren't familiar, I'm not terribly familiar with the tradition of it, except sort of like in a distanced way, but it's the first day of Lent, which is the 40 days before Easter, and which a time that a lot of religious practices will abstain from certain things, and looking forward to that. But yeah, the things that we do that just celebrate around Easter. Yeah, boy, you could do a whole episode just on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember vividly, honestly, the pandemic was the start of my deconstruction journey because Lent rolled around and I was like, I'm not giving something up right now. Are you kidding? My entire life just shrank by a factor of a million. I refuse. God wouldn't want me to. And I was kind of judged for that. And I was like, this is ludicrous. Like, why in the world would I give up more right now? So that was sort of the beginning for me. And then after that, you know, going to online mass was just hard. And so we often didn't do it, which, you know, for a Catholic, like, we are basically taught that missing mass is akin to any other mortal sin, like murder. Like, it's the same, which is.
Can I just interject that Catholic guilt is a real thing? And I mean, it's generational. Mm-hmm. I have never been Catholic like myself. But I'm telling you, from my parents and my grandparents, I can feel that stuff.
Yes.
So validated. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I started by just not giving something up for Lent. And then we eventually did go back to mass. And one of the first times we went back, the priest told us, hey, if you support abortion or the LGBTQIA community, you should get up and leave and never come back. And we were like, okay, fine. And so we haven't really been back.
because I guess at least they were clear.
They were crystal clear. The church has made its points very clear. And I am just deeply uninterested in organized religion. And honestly, at this point, I'm not so sure how interested I am in the concept of God at all. That part I'm much more uncertain about, but
that's
the idea of like identifying with the current Catholic Church, that ship has sailed. Like, I distance myself from that shit as far as can be.
Understandable. I mean, I try really hard to keep a fairly open mind, because I know you met one Catholic. You know, everybody is a little bit different, and not having been, but yeah, this whole thing of, I have a child who is trans. I am bi. I am, you know, my father-in-law is in that alphabet soup. I'm sorry, my father-in-law. It's been really interesting to sort of watch this play out in the churches and who's made what choices. One of the things, surprisingly, that actually really kind of cheered me is the Liberal Mennonite conference. I would have to do the research and look up the correct name. They actually are allowing and encouraging the ordaining of same-sex marriage, which floored me. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the Liberal Mennonite, not the Conservative Mennonite, but the Liberal Mennonite. And I was really, really tickled to see that. I was I live in Wayne County, so I'm kind of right in the hub of Amish country.
Okay.
So I'm very, very red, very, I live in a real small town that's very religious, and it's not easy to be in the alphabet mafia, I guess is the right word there, you know, as part of that. My kids have all gone through school here, you know, and it's gone a lot better than I expected, but it's nice to see those little glimmers of sanity in an otherwise scary place to be sometime for some people.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons that my husband and I want to stay in the city we're in. We originally moved here because it was so much more affordable than where we grew up. And we were like, this is fine. We'll be here for a couple of years and then we'll move back home, which home was like 45 minutes away. So it's not like we moved super far, but
this is Ohio.
That 45 minutes though makes such a difference. Like, where we live now, there's such a mix. Like, are, you know, some hateful flags flying around, but there's also lots of pride flags flying around, which I never saw in neighborhoods where I grew up. And so it's interesting. We're kind of like, we kind of want to stay.
And I think sometimes it's interesting too that you can see a reflection in those areas that are a little bit more accepting. There seems to be a little bit more religious diversity as well, at least a diversity in the different flavors of Christianity you see. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps. It's sort of like when we're challenged a little bit, you know. And again, you're still going to see that stuff that's not helpful or productive, but to see those pride flags flying, it does something to your heart. It's just it's that feels like love, you know. That to me sounds like the Jesus that I read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. Yeah. You know, if you take the words that he's recorded as having spoken, you know, I'm going to leave the question of did he exist or not aside. But if you take, I'm just going to come from the perspective of he did exist, because that's where most Christians obviously are coming from. If you take those books and what Jesus actually did while he was here, doesn't strike me that he'd be out there hating on and telling his people to exclude people of the alphabet mafia. The LGBTQIA, that seems to me he'd probably go hang out with them. Those would be the people he would go hang out with. You know, and so when you run across a group of people who are using that, are using the Bible to, what's the word I want here? Pick and choose, I guess, who they want to hang out with. That just seems really dangerous and unbiblical to me. I'll go that far. I'll tell the target on my forehead. You know, that's really unbiblical. It just is. It's not, and I don't care how literally or not literally, that literally violates what Jesus said. You either right. love your neighbor as yourself or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus didn't say which neighbor.
No.
He didn't say your Catholic neighbors. He didn't say your cishet white straight neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially this is bringing back some of the neurodivergent intersection here, but I think there's so much that a lot of, not all, obviously every neurodivergent person is different. Like you were saying about Catholics, like you meet one neurodivergent person, you met one. But I think so many of us, we do take things literally in a way that like allows us to read the Bible a little differently and hear. It just depends on what you receive, right? Because like I grew up Catholic, so we don't necessarily read the Bible on our own very often. Like culturally, that's just not something that is super promoted. Like it's fine if you do, no one's against it, but like it's not like there are other Christian denominations where reading the Bible on your own is highly, highly prized and very encouraged. That's not so much Catholicism. We hear the stories in church and then the priest interprets them for us. This leads to so much good and so much bad, because I have had priests who were incredible, honestly. Like even now that I'm like not sure how I feel about God at all, I still am really glad I had those priests in my life, because I think they spread a message of love and acceptance and really, really good things. And then I've had priests who I literally had to clench my fist and mumble under my breath in order to stop myself from standing up in the middle of mass and calling them the fuck out. It was bad. It was really bad. It was worse than being told to just leave if you don't support those things. It was even worse. It was truly disgusting. Some of this stuff. So I think as neurodivergent people, sorry, I will get to my point.
No, you're fine. You're.
I think a lot of us struggle to understand that others can lie, or that others can present information that is purely opinion, even when it sounds like it's fact. And so for me, I took everything everyone told me very, very literally, and very much like, this is fact. This is not an opinion. This is not to be argued with. This is how I felt about every authority figure in my life. And it's one of the reasons I was so traumatized by my upbringing, and my siblings weren't necessarily, because they didn't take it literally. They didn't take it apart. They just said, oh, that's just mom and dad. Like, and they just ignored it. I made it part of my ideology about how to live life. And then when I found out they were wrong, I felt so cheated and so lied to. And I think that's a big part of the religious trauma for a lot of neurodivergent people, is that feeling of like, I was such a hateful person for you on your behalf. And I just have so many regrets.
And that's really true. Well, and what struck me as you were saying that too, is that the fist clenching, you know, and trying not to stand up, I've been in that situation. And it really strikes at the heart of this sense of justice and sense of right and wrong that a lot of us on the spectrum experience. And when something that we feel is really wrong, and we can tell you why, you know, when we've got good reasons, it crosses that sense of justice for us. And we want to make it right, because as we're being harmed, I think especially as we get older and we talk about these things more, we become aware of the potential of others being harmed when we're hearing these things coming down from the pulpit or wherever it may be. You know, I think that's another way that it definitely affects those of us who are neurodivergent in a way that maybe it doesn't so much affect our neurotypical peers as well. You know, my best friend and I went through a really high control group. I'll call it that. I love Casey Davis at Domestic Blisters, and her verbiage is so good. So I'm going to steal that right now. Shout out to Casey. But she talks about that, and we went through that together, and we still talk about to this day, 20 years later, going back to that church and standing up and saying, hey, this is not okay, because that still strikes at our hearts. You know, we're both neurodivergent, but yeah, that's just another way that it affects us. And, you know, like you said, it didn't affect your siblings the same way because of the difference. Sometimes when you have a different experience from your family, that can also be a real problem. It can be really divisive within your family, which, I mean, can happen about lots of things, but this is definitely a big one. You know, most families who are religious take it fairly seriously if they identify that way. Not all of them do. And I know this is true for a lot of Catholic families. You know, it can be a matter of kicking somebody out of their family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which is particularly hard for someone who's neurodivergent. Not that it's not hard for the neurotypicals as well. I certainly don't mean to say that, but.
No, it's just that their neurotype doesn't make it harder.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like the extra spice for us, you know.
Absolutely. For a while there, before I started questioning how I felt about God in general, like when I was just like, I don't think I'm Catholic anymore. The way I described it was like, okay, I'm not religiously Catholic, but like, I'm still culturally Catholic, if that makes sense. Like there's a whole culture of, I was raised Catholic. Like that is a culture, right? Like,
absolutely. Right there. Absolutely. And there's so much that goes with that, though. And when you step away from that church, again, talk about, that's the structure yes. of the culture. And then for me, that was one of the hardest things, to step out of the religion. And I still miss that, especially, like, you know, we left the Lutheran church, the liturgical Lutheran church, when I was 7. I still miss that. Yeah. I still miss that, going to church every morning and that experience of being in the building and hearing the same words. That meant something to me. And I haven't figured this out yet, whether it has to do with, you know, God or not, or for me, it's just that experience of a ritual once a week that was somehow grounding or centering for me. But I still miss that. You know, I just want to validate that for you. That's absolutely, yeah, I don't miss the high control group that I was part of, but I miss cultural aspects that felt exactly. like community. You lose your community.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you deconstruct, sometimes you lose your family and your community, and sometimes, well, you're outright shunned. Yeah. I mean, that's a difficult place to be.
Yeah. I think I'm lucky in the sense that there is, like, there's the culture of being Catholic, and then there's the culture of having been raised Catholic, but like no longer mm-hmm. identifying that way. So like, there's still a place for me somewhere, which is really nice. but it's just interesting, like you said, that structure, because I think sometimes when we think of autism and structure, we think of like really rigid daily routines, and that can be part of it. But I think structure, we also need structure in order to existentially understand our world, just like everybody needs something that helps them understand the world. It's just autistic folks really, we focus through a specific lens, and for some of us religion even became our special interest. And so that is, it's like a death, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would agree with that. And like we were talking about, just being this time of year with it being Lent and the Passion and all that, even as as traumatizing as some of those events were, they were also pillars of the year for us, right, especially as small children. And that marked the passing of time. Some of us, like me, struggle with the concept of time in general. And I really do, like, I'm joking because I was running late today, but but I struggle with it daily, but I also struggle with the passing of years and months and weeks. It all feels the same to me. So those were kind of things that sort of set some sort of structure in place in my childhood that were sort of things that I could go, okay, now it's spring, it's Easter time, it's time for this. You know, yeah. And when you sort of lose touch with those, it's unmooring. But, you know, it's hard too when you have things that are both helpful and hurtful.
Yeah.
And as a neurodivergent, I think it can give us really unique insights. Like you said, we see things through a different lens, and I think we're able to see things differently. And I think sometimes we're able to see how two things can be true at the same time a little bit more effectively. And I think that's really helpful, actually, in being neurodivergent and being able to hold sort of two truths at once. But it's also very tricky sometimes, yes, to figure out. It really can be, you know, and I think that continues to evolve and change. You know, I don't think we're ever done figuring it all out, which is terrifying and awful all at the same time. And wonderful. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. Well, for people who maybe zoned out and are now zoning back in because they can sense that we're getting towards the end of the episode, what is one thing that you want people to take away from our conversation today? And when it comes to neurodivergence and religious trauma?
I think based on what we said today, I would like to validate that whatever your experience is, in whether you're deconstructing, whether you're just sort of even beginning to consider what's happening with this or question where you're at, your experience is valid. Whatever you're feeling is valid. If it feels way bigger than it feels like it ought to feel, there's a good reason for that. And it's okay to grieve. It's okay to grieve and be thankful at the same time. You know, you can be really glad that you had these experiences, but also recognize how it fucked you up and you've got work to do. So, and that's okay. And the other thing too, I think that I would have wanted to hear, is you're not alone.
Yeah.
You're not alone. I'm so glad that this is becoming a bigger conversation, because I felt alone about it for a really long time. And I don't ever want anybody to feel that way. Because it can be a very, very lonely road to walk, and it sucks.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I love that we ended on validation and connection, because so often in high control groups, those are not things that you receive. So
maybe that's why they're so important to me now.
Yes. Yes. 100%. Okay. Well, Karen, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for your time and your vulnerability and just discussing all of this with me today.
No, no problem. It's something that I'm always working on, and I'm always glad to talk about it. Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate your time.
Of course. All right, everybody. I will talk with you next Saturday. Bye. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you give us a follow over on Spotify, leave a review over on Apple Podcasts, and tune in next Saturday for another amazing episode.